It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
This week's Democratic National Convention was like no other. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Gone were the large crowds that filled the hall with the hats and campaign buttons. The roll call for the presidential nomination saw representatives located in their states casting ballots to put former Vice President Joe Biden over the top to become the presidential nominee. Convention wrapped up with Biden making his acceptance speech, and there were 18 politicians like the Clintons, disaffected Republicans, as well as a new generation such as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. To assess the convention, we have two Salisbury University political science professors. Online with us is Adam Hoffman, and in the studio, Michael Laughlin. Well, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Don.
Good morning.
So, Adam, I'm going to turn to you and ask you, what was your overall sense about how this convention went?
I thought it went pretty well. I mean, everyone was surprised, as you said. There's never been a televised, political convention like this without the crowds, without the balloons, without the sort of raucous cheering. I mean, in past conventions, the role of the convention is to do just that, have that party to really amplify the message of the base. But I think they pulled it off. And maybe that has something to do with the fact that, we were just talking offline about how popular Zoom has become. People are kind of used to this medium. It allowed the politicians and the speakers to have a sort of, I think, more intimate connection with the audience to communicate their message. It wasn't overly produced, so it wasn't, a slick presentation, which some people were sort of afraid of. But I think they hit a lot of important points that they wanted to with this fairly new way of doing conventions.
Michael, it does seem as if, absent the crowds, the messages became much clearer. There wasn't the distraction of all the hoopla. And perhaps that this was the right form at the right time, given what we're experiencing.
Well, the one critical goal of any convention, party convention, is to unify behind the presidential nominee. And I think that the Democrats successfully did that. They achieved that goal. It was clear. I mean, with Senator Warren and Senator Sanders were speaking up for Biden, and so that the warring parties within the divisions that are there within the Democratic Party were at least covered over and unified in the presentation of the convention. It remains to be seen, of course, is whether or not the convention will have get a bump in the polls, because that's another kind of goal that you want to see, that you have motivated voters, both the Democrats and certainly independents, and additionally inspiring the coalition activists. I mean, that remains to be seen as well, but I think it's promising. I mean, I think that Biden gave a very strong speech at the end. And there are going to be plenty of clips from that I think can be quite useful.
Alan, turning to Biden's address, one of the observations actually made by Chris Wallace over at Fox was that essentially Biden had blown a hole, as it were, in this claim by Trump that he's this doddering old man, that he hasn't really got it together, that he stumbles around. It seems as if he really kind of dispelled that.
Yeah, I mean, again, to without an audience, I think if an audience was there, he would have blown them away. I mean, it was a pretty energetic speech. He made as did the whole convention, but certainly in the culmination of Biden's speech, making the contrast between the president and him, casting it in terms of lightness and darkness, and I think that was a pretty powerful argument by Biden. I just want to pick up also one thing that Mike was saying about the activist base. I mean, I think if I were to criticize the convention. I mean, I think that was the one thing that they didn't do enough. I don't think they had enough of the really sort of progressive wing of the Democratic Party. I don't think they gave them nearly enough airtime. On the other hand, as Mike also said, I mean, I think you had Sanders really gave a quote of full-throated endorsement and, you know, made the case that his supporters this time around should not stay home, right? But, you know, we'll see, as Mike said, if that's going to be enough.
Yeah, if I may just double down on part of that, one sense, the digital format, this virtual format, is the campaign manager's dream, because it does give the campaign much more control over how things are going to unfold during the convention, whereas the real life convention, I mean, these days they're more controlled than I think certainly in past decades, but nonetheless, you know, the 2016 Democratic convention was raucous because there was disagreement and the divisions were exhibited on the convention floor and the speeches and the like. And while the downside is you don't get the kind of unified message, the upside is that's really Democratic politics with a small d. That is that you really do get a sense how we see these different points of view and the base for those views. And I think Adam's absolutely right that there was really insufficient voice here from the Warren camp and from the Sanders camp, that we didn't see enough of that, and I think. And so it was perhaps in that respect it went over the edge a little bit in terms of too much of a managed presentation.
Well, one of the things that struck me, and over a number of different speakers, including Biden, but as well as former President Obama, and even the historian John Meacham, was this idea that this was greater than just simply the politics of the moment or even a particular platform, that this was, to use their words, obviously, you fight for the soul of America, that there was something that beyond simply party politics. Obviously, they brought in some Republicans, not the A-list, but they were there nonetheless, endorsing Biden. But it does seem as if, Alan, as if they tried to raise this above just simply the normal election give and take.
Yeah. I mean, this was definitely, I mean, this was the first convention or modern convention where you saw this presentation of this, the greatest threat to America, to lives, to freedoms. It wasn't a foreign nation, terrorism, Wall Street. It was the person in the Oval Office currently, the incumbent president. And, you know, you've never seen a theme that take place at a political convention. So, yeah, I mean, sort of this larger-than-life issues, again, presenting this contrast between, you know, the light of Biden and the decency and calmness that he can offer, and the chaos and darkness of Trump and then the president administration. You know, that was the theme that was woven throughout all the nights. I thought it was really, interesting and I guess predictable that, again, sort of the main theme that came up, of course, was the pandemic, right? And just presenting the pandemic and the results of it as this crisis of leadership. I mean, just about every speaker, you know, hit home on that point. So that was definitely a unifying theme throughout.
As a matter of fact, I mean, former President Obama certainly struck that, essentially saying that he hasn't grown into the job. And it seems as if it certainly got a response, certainly from the president. I mean, he tweeted a number of times. He said, quote, he being Obama, spied on my campaign, got caught, made some reference to not endorsing Biden right away, I guess, during the campaign. So it does seem to me, Michael, that that he did hit a chord there with the president.
For sure. I mean, I think that Barack Obama's speech was one of the most important speeches of the convention, and clearly went after the basic character of Trump. I'd add an additional piece to that, one phrase within the speech, of course, was Trump and his enablers.
And that wasn't a particularly disguised critique of other Republican officials within the Republican Party, so that he was taking aim at the down ballots as well. I think that's that was an important piece. The even that could have been, I think, vocalized more loudly during the convention. That this is the problem that we face is not simply this particular president, but a party, the Republican Party, that has become corrupted and is enabling the undermining of basic democratic principles. So the problem is perhaps more severe than the simple president.
Alan, do you think it went that far? I mean, I know that that the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi linked Trump to McConnell in her criticism of the president, but that seemed to me about as far as it went in terms of attacking the party per se. That it was really focused on Trump, and obviously the Republicans who spoke feel that well, maybe if this is over, that they can rejoin their party. Do you think there was enough emphasis on that? How do you see that playing out?
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with Mike. I mean, there wasn't, but you know, I'm not sure if there necessarily had to be. Again, you know, the convention, you know, it was focused on one person, really. It was focused on Donald Trump, and you know, as much as Obama sort of weaved in the Constitution, and I think that was a powerful argument, he really did not hold back on Trump, right? Making this powerful argument that that Trump is either lazy or intellectually overwhelmed, or maybe both. I mean, it was scorching criticism on Obama's part. One quote Obama said in the speech: "The circus of it all, the beanness, the lies, the conspiracy theories." Really, Obama sort of typical pedantic tone of parental tone of disbelief and anguish that I've tapped into what a lot of people feel about the Trump administration. So, you know, I even though there were a few nights, as I said, the focus really was on one man, not necessarily the party that he represents right now.
Michael, the other thing I noticed was that women played a large role in this, not only as the hosts, as it were, for each night, but there was a great deal of emphasis on that. I'm assuming, in part, from a tactical point of view, obviously, they want women to turn out for Biden. But are they trying to say more than that, do you think, than just simply a political tactic?
I think it perhaps is reflective of the growing gender gap between the two parties. I think I just saw a recent poll that was incredible in terms of the double-digit lead presently that Biden has with regard to women. So I think that is reflective, but I think just many more women now within the Democratic Party than in the Republican Party. And again, I think in terms of the House of Representatives, the number of women are extraordinary versus very few actually Republican women there. So I think it's reflective of that, of the power of women now within the Democratic Party. But I would think as well, it is tactical as well, because a key voting constituency now that's being targeted, of course, is suburban women. Trump wants to classify those folks as 1950s housewives, but that's incorrect. And I think that the Democrats wisely were targeting that particular constituency during the convention.
Alan, what do you think?
Adam, I think you're calling me Adam.
Oh, I'm sorry, Adam. Go ahead.
I mean, it was really, they took advantage of showcasing the, you know, incredibly important role that was now every couple of years, like, okay, this is it, you know, this is an increasing amount of women got elected. But, I mean, this is... there's no going back right now as far as the dominant role that women are going to begin to play in the Democratic Party, both in the elected officials, when you had the New Mexico governor, Pelosi, Gabrielle Giffords, a heartfelt speech, Harris and Clinton, and so, and of course, and as Mike said, they're such an important dominant role, both as elected officials and in the electorate. And, that was, of course, illustrated by Biden's early promise that his VP pick would be a woman, and that's exactly what he did. That was a very important message for the Democratic Party to get across during this convention.
I want to turn it to Kamala Harris. She made her debut, as it were, I guess. Michael, first of all, what did you make of the address, and how effective do you think it was?
Of all the speeches, I thought that her speech, unfortunately, was the weak one of the weaker speeches. Frankly, now to be sure, VP candidates have to have a more subdued presentation because they can't upstage the nominee, the presidential nominee. But I thought in terms just of her style, I didn't find it as exciting. Having said that, however, I think that the substance of her speech, she was clearly going after the African-American community to mobilize that constituency, because that has powered Biden to the nomination, and it will be the power that will bring about his presidency, if that turns out to be the case. So I think it was effective in that case.
Adam, what do you think? I mean, because at one point I noticed she said, talking about how she had been a prosecutor, and there's that line, which I missed initially, which was, quote, "I know a predator when I see one," and then she paused. What do you make of that?
She did pull any punches when it came to calling out Trump, with regard to that. I mean, I also agree with Mike. I could clearly... If you were a fly in the wall of the people who were directing her, they told her, you better tone it down, because, of course, we've seen her, much more enthusiastic over-the-top speeches when she was on the campaign trail. But, as Mike said, they clearly told her to tone it down. But even with that, Don, no, you're right. I mean, when she really called out Trump, talk about his callousness and incompetence and cynicism, right? She said, right now we have a president who turns our tragedies into political weapons. Even though she definitely called out Trump and, didn't pull any punches, I think most of her speech was sort of an optimistic, more of this affirmation that we're not necessarily trapped in this Trump era, that there's a way to get out of it. By coming out to vote for Dell.
One of the other things that struck me is that when I was watching some of the speakers, Clinton and obviously Biden, but others, that a lot of them seem to be old. I mean, they got old somehow, and it stood in contrast. And obviously, as a matter of fact, they dominated. It seemed to me. Sort of the major features, as it were, as opposed to the younger generation, which we saw, in the little cameos and the lots of little clips and so on. But the heavy hitters, Michael, still seem to be that older generation. And do you think, in some ways, and I was beginning to wonder whether or not this was going to be the last time we see these people, or most of them? What do you think, Mike?
That assumes that we're still around for as well. So right. Maybe we're not going to see anything. But I think that's true. And I think it was, I wasn't in the back rooms where they were planning this thing, but they have to have been strategic about this. So I think part of it is that the aim is to eat away. I mean, Biden certainly wants to eat away at any kind of Trump advantage with regard to the older citizen. And again, as we were talking about before the show, the Biden is not even a baby boomer. He's a wartime.
Right.
So he's really a throwback in this respect. But he has the ability really to appeal to the older voter. And I think that part of the lineup here of all of these older speakers, you know, again, it's reflective. I mean, Sanders was important, prominent, right? Clearly competitive. So I think that the choice then was made. And perhaps there was some error as well, because I think Ocasio-Cortez, for example, perhaps could have been given a larger time frame as well. But they chose to go older rather than younger, and it has to be for a strategic reason. I mean, older voters are more reliable voters, okay? Perhaps that was the choice.
Adam, do you think in some ways this convention will seen as maybe a transition convention when it comes to the older generation as opposed to the newer people coming up?
Yeah, I mean, you could really look at it as sort of like a handoff to the younger generation, you know, and you could even say that. I think a lot of people have been talking, you know, people sort of suspect that you know, Biden, whether or not he's going to serve out his term, serve two terms, that this is, as you said, a sort of a transition, passing the torch from these older generations of Democrats, your Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leadership in Congress, and the Democratic nominee. I agree with what you guys were saying about, I mean, at least the first part of the convention, the first couple of nights, it didn't really offer much to younger voters. You had Colin Powell, Kerry, Kasich. I mean, these people do not have a lot of millennial or Gen Z fans. You know, so, I mean, I think a lot of progressives were kind of worried about the older, you know, the tone catering to older folks in the first couple of days of the convention. This generation gap is really, I mean, this is a very important sort of cleavage within the Democratic Party, right? But, I mean, I think later on they tried to make up for it, right? I mean, they had some of the important issues that have animated young people, like gun control and climate change, right? You had the musical performances by Billie Eilish, which, you know, most people over 50 or 60 had no idea who she was. But, I mean, she has, you know, 60 million followers on Instagram. So, you know, maybe that did something to get young people to pay attention.
Well, one of the things that struck me is looking at this convention is that we may be seeing a transition of sorts between what used to be the Democratic Leadership Council, the group that came out of the 1980s. Bill Clinton was obviously an advocate of it, in which there was a shift to more conservative or shift to the right for the Democratic Party, particularly during the 1990s, as a reaction to Reagan. We're now seeing, though, another generation, which oddly enough is represented by Bernie Sanders, but it's a progressive wing, which is pushing now beyond that Democratic Leadership Council idea of a reaction to Reaganism. Mike, do you think that's true?
Oh, absolutely. I think one way to put it is, when Bill Clinton said, when he was nominated, the era of big government is over, the progressive response now is, enter big government, enter activist federal programs, and the federal government is the only institution that can really save us, in effect. And even Biden, who really represents more the Clinton perspective, I would suggest, in his speech, he ticked off, you know, the pandemic, climate change, health care, and the like, and unemployment, that so that there is at least a hint that if a Biden presidency would at least be supportive of significantly greater federal government involvement and regulation and programs alike. I would hasten to say as well, the divisions within the Democratic Party remain big, because we didn't hear Medicare for all. We didn't hear the Green New Deal. We didn't hear a wealth tax, which are all, I think, critical policy positions, ideological policy positions of the progressive left, that I think if Biden does win, then the pressure will be on for those particular programs. But that was sort of hazed over in the convention.
Adam, I want to turn to, by the way, the Republicans that were there. I mentioned a moment ago that they were not obviously the A team, whatever that may be. How effective do you think they were? I mean, we had a lot of disaffected Republicans, but what does that really represent? Is that just simply a reaction to Donald Trump? And when it's all over, they all go back to the old party. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think you had, you know, the Democrats had that parade of Republican office holders, you know, saying that they endorsed Biden, not because necessarily they agreed with him and his policies, but, you know, they're focusing solely on Trump. They couldn't bear watching what Trump was doing to their party, was doing to their country. And I think it might have some effect. I mean, along with the Lincoln Project and so forth, it gives some moderate, centrist Republicans sort of a little bit of cover, a little bit of confidence that they could, vote for someone other than a Republican for president. And, you know, even if they end up splitting their chicken and voting for their representatives who are Republican, this would be the time, as, you know, given permission, given sort of that suggestion by fellow Republicans that now is the time that you could pull the lever for someone with a D, at least at the presidential level. So I think that might have had sort of some impact. Just for a second, I just want to go back to what you were talking about before, the battle between progressives and sort of the more corporate DLC, the Democratic Party. Yeah, I mean, I think that's extremely important. In the press, the party got a little bit of flack because at the very last minute, the platform, they took out a very important point about giving subsidies to fossil fuel industries. And the environmentalists were just fuming at the fact that they did that at the last minute. But that clearly represents this sort of intra-battle war that they're having now, and that they will certainly have if Biden gets elected within the Democratic Party in Congress.
Now, Michael, I'll turn to you finally quickly in the minute we have left. What do you think we expect from the Republicans next week?
It's a fascinating... I don't know. I mean, I was thinking about this on the way over, actually. So what's going to be the reaction here? Or what's going to be the... How will I mean, it's going to be a Trump show, and I guess the focus, I suspect we'll see the law and order theme carried out here. I suspect we will see, I mean, Trump is a character assassin, and so I think there's going to be a lot of attack on Joe Biden's age and Sleepy Joe, that kind of thing, I think will appear as well. I think there will be appeal to what preceded the pandemic, I mean, the strength of the economy and the like. I think we're going to have this notion that, well, if not for the pandemic, things would be wonderful. The pandemic, the virus will disappear, and we'll get back to the good old days prior to the pandemic. So my suspicion will be that that'll be the kind of character of it, but only Trump knows.
Well, on that note,
the culture wars.
The culture wars. Well, we've been speaking with two political scientists from Salisbury University, Adam Hoffman, as well as Michael Laughlin. Appreciate both of you taking the time to sit in and talk about this morning.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Don.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.